New licensing requirements have teachers scrambling. New tariffs from President Trump. That plus Curtis Hill's staff salary bumps and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 17th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, thousands of teachers scrambled to start the process of renewing their teaching licenses before new requirements go into effect. The new law requires teachers to take 15 hours towards the 90 they need to renew their licenses through workforce and career navigation-focused programs. Those could be earned through an externship with a company or professional development opportunities that focus on career navigation for students or economic and workforce needs in their local community. The change comes from the governor's workforce cabinet, which says the new requirements are the result of a push to strengthen partnerships with employers and raise awareness of community needs outside of schools. The cabinet says guidance on what those 15 required hours might entail will come soon, but the state's largest teachers union says educators feel blindsided by the change, and they see it as an insult and another added burden. Is this the right step for teacher licensing? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, is this a good idea that's perhaps been poorly rolled out?
Well, it's hard to roll it out in a clean way when the Indiana State Teachers Association isn't being totally honest about their involvement in this. To say that they got blindsided is ridiculous. They were at the table the entire session. They testified on this. The fact that teachers that are in their current licensing period and trying to meet that 90-hour requirement are exempt from this was the ISTA's idea, and the Republicans put it in the bill. And it's not like this was hidden in last-day language. This was in House Bill 1002, which means other than the budget, it's the number one priority of Republicans in the legislature this year. So this wasn't a situation where Republicans were hiding anything. This was an open discussion and a collaborative discussion with the ISTA. That doesn't match at all what they're saying right now.
Should there have been more discussion? I mean, because I think the thing that a lot of teachers are struggling with is what does this mean?
Right,
and we don't have a lot of answers, I think, to that.
Right,
so far.
And so what's exacerbated this is now the Department of Education has said, you got to get your license done by July 1st, but only if you want to be exempt for this for the next 5 years or for the next 90-hour period. So this urgency is manufactured and unnecessary because they are going to define what this is and should, because right now we have an expectation in Indiana, we've created this expectation as we should, that when students leave school, they ought to be prepared to go into the workforce, whether that's high school or college. They should be prepared to go into the workforce. And we put that expectation on teachers with no resources as to what that actually means currently. And so now we're trying to define within the existing 90-hour requirement that they already have to do. Here are 15 that focus on this. And the private sector is going to have to come to the table in your community and create, and they already have, created these resources for teachers to go take advantage of.
So then is this been overblown because, as he talked about, the timing isn't as bad as it seems?
Well, the timing is bad. And the reason the timing is bad is because the teachers didn't get the raises that they should have gotten. And on top of this, they get another mandate from the state legislature. I've got a great idea. Before the state legislature puts any more mandates on teachers about what they should do, how about they spend 15 hours in the classroom to find out what it's like? I mean, all they do is dictate from above without any expectation of what's going on. And then they discourage people from going into education as a profession, both by want of decent salaries for it and mandates that come down one after another, whether it's on testing or whatever the idea du jour is of the legislature. I think they ought to go spend some time in the classrooms.
Suzanne have a point here in terms of this isn't being done in a vacuum. This is amidst a lot of licensing changes.
Right, it comes when teachers are already feeling put upon. They don't feel like they got the raise they deserved. We already are going through teacher shortage and morale issues. So let's just Let's just throw another mandate on them. And I agree with you. There wasn't anything surprise about it. But let's be clear. I was in that building every day of that session, and I never heard about that.
Well, it's not that huge of a deal. It's no different than, like, a lot of professions have to get continuing education. And the law or those committees say, well, part of this should be, if you're a lawyer, 1 year hours has to be in ethics. It's no different than that.
Except those courses already exist. Yeah, and you just go sign up for that course. You don't go have to find an externship in rural Indiana. And what does it matter? I mean, can a third grade teacher really learn anything on workforce issues?
And what is she going to implement in the third grade to prepare them?
Is that perhaps the biggest problem so far? Is that we don't have the answers to some of these basic questions about what this means?
Sure, it's the uncertainty. It's a lack of clarity, perhaps. I mean, Mike spelled it out well. But maybe that message has not gotten out to every teacher. And so when teachers, their inference, their interpretation is, I've got to act now. I've got to figure out something on my own to go out and effectively get an externship or an internship or whatever the nomenclature is. And I think that's what's unnerving. That and the fact that, as has been spelled out here, runs against sort of the move that we have seen more broadly where, because of the shortage, because of the exodus of teachers from the classroom, we've just, as a state, done the opposite. Look for ways to get mid-career professionals, for instance, into the classroom with an expedited certification process or dispense with the certification process altogether in some ways.
So that seems to misunderstand the profession of teaching.
It seems maybe to go opposite directions. I don't think it's a bad thing, certainly, but it maybe is just, it's going to take time to settle in. One way to give teachers an increase, which is what everybody said they wanted to do but couldn't.
Force them to get another job?
No. I was going to say pay them to do this with state dollars.
That's true.
That would have been legal.
I want to ask both of you this, which is we heard some lawmakers now talk about, well, maybe we need to come back and take a look at these requirements and see if they don't need to be changed as early as next session. Is that going to cause more problems, though?
Yeah, because you're going to have teachers that are in you may have teachers that are done with their previous 90-hour, now they're starting a new one, right? And so they may take the next 12 months and actually engage in this activity, and then the legislature comes back and says, you don't need it. Never mind, we don't need it.
But the legislature can exempt those that have done that in good faith based on the reliance of a half-baked idea that
but there's already been so many changes are going to feel like.
This is just what they do. This is just what they do with the evaluations and the testing. You know, you have a system. You don't look at it. You don't see how it works. You change it the next year, and then you change it the following year.
Well, there should be. I mean, to Nikki's point, there are going to be gaps where you have a rural teacher who says, "I just don't have access to this stuff, or to this programming," and they're going to have to figure out how to deliver the opportunity to complete fulfill this requirement,
but the good news is they have time to do it
because it's not
urgent. Kindergarten, first, second, third grades are really important for this prospect.
All right. Well, moving on, consumers can expect to see rising costs on everything from toilet paper and light fixtures to computers and furniture as President Trump imposed new tariffs on Chinese goods.
Retailers say they can't absorb the extra costs from the Trump administration's increased tariffs on billions of dollars in Chinese imports. If no deal is reached with China, the president also threatens another wave of tariffs that would cover almost all other goods, including clothing and shoes. American farmers could also face financial repercussions if the trade war with China continues. In the past, China has retaliated with tariffs against agricultural imports from the U.S. Those are still in effect, and the Asian giant put new tariffs this week on $60 billion worth of American goods.
And Delaney, if this trade war continues, does it have electoral repercussions in Indiana?
I think it could. Obviously, consumer prices are going to go up. That's a given. But it's hitting the farmers, and it's hitting manufacturers too. I mean, when you see John Deere's stock downgraded because they're concerned that farmers aren't going to be able to buy the equipment they need to farm because the prices have gone up, and the prices for soybeans, corn, pork, all have gone down as a result of this. I mean, China took 60% of the soybean crop last year, okay? And they're not taking 60% of the soybean crop this year, which is why soybeans are down in value and corn is down in value. And that's hitting farmers at a particularly hard time because the weather has not cooperated this spring. And in addition to that, you've got the problem with when they want to replace equipment, they can't afford it anymore, which is why from till June of 2018, over the previous year, the number of farm bankruptcies doubled. okay? And that was before a lot of these things really hit. So it's going to have an impact. It's going to have an impact on a state like Indiana, which is both manufacturing and agriculture, and it's worrisome.
But manufacturing and farming, that sounds like two constituencies that belong to Republicans for the most part in this state. So is that put this on a more tenuous track?
Well, it could, but you could also argue that 2016, in part, was a reaction to trade imbalances with trading partners like China that put Donald Trump in the White House to begin with. You know, and he's right, I think, to play hardball here, because they go and have these negotiations and agree on, make some, there's some concession made, particularly on the most recent on intellectual property, and then the negotiators go back home, and the trade hardliners hammer them, and then they go, well, we can't agree to that. And so they go and agree to things, and we get closer to a trade deal, and then China comes in and dials it back. And so the president, I think, is right, at least hopefully on a short-term basis, of hammering these guys to keep them at the table.
But you know what's worrisome about that is that I don't think anybody wins in a trade war. I don't think we lose maybe as much as the Chinese, but I don't think we win. And what concerns me about this is the Chinese are going to find other markets to buy these products from. And the question is, do they come back to us?
That's a real long-term risk. That's right. That's right. And you're not trying to win as much as you're trying to make it, I think, what the president is. So we're trying to make it even. We're trying to level it out.
Some politicians in the state have tried to play the, I agree with the goals, but I don't love what's happening in the short term. Is a voter out there going to hear that and go, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine?
Well, that's what this comes down to, Brandon, in the end, is what message people who are affected and harmed by this, what they listen to, whom they believe. Do they believe the administration or their own lying eyes, as the expression might say? The president's message has been, this is something we have to do for America. This is about a long, maybe pain in the short term, but it's worth it for the long-term gain. And that's something that probably plays well with certain aspects of his constituency. We've seen Donald Trump supporters on any number of issues be willing to relegate, well, seemingly relegate their own self-interest, economic interest, in the interest of advancing this larger cause that he has articulated.
And that goes back to what you said in terms of what the 2016 election was in part a reaction to, I think.
Yeah, the demographics are all bizarre on
but
this.
What it shows
if you're a steel worker, you're great. If you're a rural farmer, you're not.
It shows the division just between the traditional Republican philosophy, I say traditional, in the past few cycles, where it's basically embracing free trade. And so... and maybe that was a departure from the average Hoosier Republican voter. Maybe this is more in line with what maybe he knows how to read the electorate better than we do.
Particularly when it comes to farmers, obviously they're hurting, and we hear how much they're hurting, but they're also then getting payments from the government to help offset some of that pain. So if you're a farmer and you see, on the one hand, yikes, but on the other hand, well, they're trying to help us a little, does that even it out for you?
Maybe for a few months. I mean, you know, maybe a year. But if this moves into 2020, I mean, that's not short term anymore, I guess. I mean,
you're talking about a couple years at this point.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, we got to see the progress or people are going to back away. Yeah.
And you also have it where it's going to hit the consumers now. And the estimates are between 500 and 900 per household.
Yeah, Walmart is already talking about raising prices.
Is already going to be affected
and
by
it
this.
Makes, well,
it's
going to
hit people on the lower end of the spectrum more
and
harsh.
It makes total economic sense. This idea that somehow tariffs shouldn't, I mean, of course they're going to find their way in the product.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how the economy works.
Right. It's a short term, it's a good tool. But right now, retailers are buying products for Christmas. And so if it's short-term and we have a deal in August, well, the prices are still going to be up in December.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then the question is, do they buy next year, or does that deflate
right.
the economy as well?
So it's a good short-term tool, but it's got to be short-term.
Yeah. Well, time
how do we define short-term?
Yeah, that's a question for another week. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question, will continued tariffs have negative consequences for President Trump at the ballot box in Indiana? A yes or B no. Last week's question, is Governor Holcomb's relative lack of vetoes a positive or a negative? 14% of you say it's a positive, 53% say a negative, but 33% say it's really neither. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, several senior members of Attorney General Curtis Hill's staff recently received significant raises, some as high as 14%, and Curtis Hill is defending those bumps.
In an interview with the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's and IWIR's Nikki Kelly, Attorney General Curtis Hill says the raises are not about rewarding loyalty to those who stuck by him after last year's sexual misconduct allegations. Instead, Hill argues the increases are meant to make the salaries more competitive with other state agencies and the private sector. For example, Chief of Staff Mary Beth Bonaventura took a $40,000 pay cut when she came to the office, initially as special counsel, from her role as Director of the Department of Child Services. She's now making almost $170,000 a year. That's more than just about any other chief of staff in Indiana state government. And there are only 53 state employees who actually make more than her, including various agency heads, Indiana's Supreme Court justices, and doctors at state hospitals. Hill says an internal study found his office was often losing quality people to other agencies, leaving a gap in experience that required repeated training investments.
Nikki Kelly, obviously we're looking at this in the light of what's going on over the past year or so with Curtis Hill, but this goes back further for him, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, he brought up the issue of income sort of equalization, as he calls it, very early in his tenure and trying to keep lawyers in the office. And in fact, the largest phase of this, it cost about $1 million, happened last year for about half of the staff. But, you know, the smaller phase that recently happened kind of hit the people who are more well-known in the office, have a little more, you know, I guess,
on the top
notoriety.
End of the salary scales, yeah. Anyway, too.
And so these look like very large increases. And then the final phase will be later this year.
Does Curtis Hill have a point here that in order to keep talent, you have to, I mean, you've made that argument before on a lot of issues. In order to keep talent.
I say it for teachers, too, and we didn't give them the raise.
But in order to keep talent, you got to pay them more.
I think that is a legitimate argument. I've never been somebody who thought that we should be chintzy when it comes to public servants, whether they're elected or whether they're non-merit or merit employees. And I think you look at salaries, and it probably would encourage some to look elsewhere in the private sector. And we all know.
And he acknowledged he can't compete with the private
sector.
Well,
you can't compete, but you have other incentives. But you want to at least get closer to having a level playing field. And we all know that recruitment is a lot more expensive, and churn, employee turnover and churn is a lot more expensive than trying to make a positive atmosphere where you want to keep people around. So I can't really fault him. I guess if he can't, you know, he's got to balance his own office budget as a state elected official. So ultimately, if he can do it, more power to him.
If this were any agency other than the AG's office, anyone other than Curtis Hill, would we be talking about it?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, any time we adjust salaries, especially in a significant way, it's news, and it should be. This is real similar, I think, to the debate several years ago about the judge pay that we have to. Part of this is it's public service, right? So you're not going to go and be on par with the private sector. Curtis Hill is essentially running a 150-person law firm, 150-lawyer law firm, right? And so that is not being paid if you walk into any other law firm in town on the same basis. But the job's a little bit different. It's public service, so you've got to say, if you're working there, as I didn't say government, you got to take that into consideration. In the AG's office, you need continuity, and you need people to stay for a long time, unlike being the head of a state agency that is a political appointment, and it's a short-term, more of a short-term deal.
Yeah, a lot of people, probably in that first round last year, were people who've been there through multiple administrations of different attorneys general.
Yeah, they were largely their deputy attorney generals in the first round.
Is this, I sort of the same question, if this were somebody other than Curtis Hill, would we care as much about these
increases? I think in light of what happened in the last session of the legislature, there would still be a discussion of it. I do think, in conjunction with what has already been said, that state salaries are too low. I thought that for a long time. But it's also true for the rank and file in all of the agencies. People that are making $2,000 a month having been there for 10 years, that's ridiculous. And they voted down. Republicans would not vote for a $15 minimum wage in Indiana. For state employees.
Right.
Would not vote for increasing teacher pay adequately. And then having this come on top of it, when you have teachers making $32,000 a year, and then you have $170,000 a year, or whatever that pay increase was to, it sends a message that if you're part of the elite, you're going to be taken care of. But if you're doing public service work in the rank and file, forget it. We don't care about you. That's the message it sends, and that's unfortunate.
Well, the state of Indiana this week proposed a new program to to help transition people from its Medicaid expansion program, HIP 2.0, to commercial health insurance.
If the federal government approves it, Indiana's HIP Workforce Bridge will be the first program of its kind. Essentially, the state would allow HIP members to use money in their health savings accounts, known as power accounts, for up to a year after getting a job that provides them with health insurance. FSSA Secretary Jennifer Walthall says the Workforce Bridge is designed to help avoid the so-called cliff effect, a period of time when health care costs are still a major concern even after someone gets a new job. The proposal is paired with the state's new work requirements for some Medicaid expansion recipients. Those requirements mandate that people have, eventually, 20 hours a week in work-related activities, which could include a job, education and training, looking for a job, or volunteer work. Similar, though more draconian, Medicaid work requirements in other states have been blocked in federal court.
John Schwanis, is this workforce bridge in some ways an effort to ward off a lawsuit or a loss in court?
I think those people who are inclined to take issue with this in, through litigation, the work requirement, this is...
Undeterred.
This really doesn't matter to them. It may, at the margins, placate some individuals, but I don't think it stops that. So I guess what you're left with is presumably a sincere desire to help bridge that gap, hence the name Bridge. When you have individuals who may be starting a new job and don't get benefits immediately
or maybe they
maybe don't have the wherewithal or capital to pay those initial premiums, this certainly helps that. And another indicator, I think, of that is an acknowledgement of some tweaking that needed to take place with the age of those who have dependents at home. It's, what, 7 years old now?
No,
and
it would 30. Go.
John, leave something for the rest
yeah,
of us.
Yeah, that's exactly,
well,
that's,
I didn't
that's
know.
Exactly
I
what I wanted to talk to you about. Is this an acknowledgement that they are trying to listen to the complaints that people have?
Well, yeah, on that specific issue, this is part of the work requirement itself. Originally, the exemption was going to be for caretakers for dependents under seven. And after listening to comments and public hearings, they, in this submission, changed it to under 13. So they definitely are listening as well as also creating this new bridge program.
Fundamentally, is the bridge program a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think it would be even better idea if we paid everybody enough to be able to afford their own insurance, but I think it's a good way to help people make the transition to being fully independent. I don't have a problem with it.
There is this perhaps threat of a lawsuit hanging over the work requirements, even if Indiana's are different from the other states that have been struck down or sued even. Does this, to get back to my original question, does this placate anybody?
I think it's a separate issue, I think. But I think it's fundamental to the difference in how both parties view these programs, whereas I think Republicans tend to view them as they should be temporary, and we want to help you get off of it at some point. The Medicaid program, but then Democrats believe that these should be, particularly at the federal level, Medicare for All, and all the, you know, it's these 26 or 30 presidential candidates complaining about this. But look, the Medicaid program is no longer pregnant women and children,
no,
or the blind
it's
and the disabled.
It's a broader population.
And the push at the federal level is to make it for all working people. And so if you have that...
As an option.
At a percent of federal poverty.
Yeah.
Is where we've put that in the federal law.
But a heavy percentage of the people that are on Medicaid...
We never contemplate it would be on Medicaid, And so
it's changing the program.
A heavy percentage of them will never be gainfully employed and can't be gainfully employed.
Not with that attitude.
All right, moving on. In the middle of the 2019 legislative session, two Republican lawmakers helped wage what the Journal Gazette's Nikki Kelly called a backroom crusade to save a first-of-its-kind Ivy Tech baseball team.
2 years ago, Ivy Tech Fort Wayne started a baseball team, the first sports team at any Ivy Tech campus. Only they didn't give Ivy Tech president Sue Elsperman a heads up. So Elsperman eventually agreed to a 2-year pilot program. And this year, the Ivy Tech board did not vote to extend the program, which was funded through donations and revenue generated by the team. So Fort Wayne representatives Bob Morris and Chris Judy got involved. Calls and texts to legislators, the governor, anyone who would listen, led to a new vote supporting the Ivy Tech Titans in April. Morris, by the way, was the one who came up with the idea of having a baseball team at Ivy Tech years ago. He is longtime friends with the coach, contributed financially to the program, and his son plays on the team.
Mike O'Brien, harmless advocacy or bordering on a more serious conflict of interest?
There's no downside to this. This is a volunteer effort by him to put this in place. It's wildly popular. The team's successful. It's all paid for with private donations. And the graduation rate among these students is close to 100%.
Yeah, maybe 92% all of the baseball team. Is this just
great.
A good? Is this just
a
good thing?
Do they hand out Girl Scout cookies when they have their matches, or what?
I don't know. No one remembers that.
You have to go back.
I think a few people remember that. Nikki Kelly, is this have more? But there are some serious long-term implications.
Yeah, it's easy to be like, oh, that's a great team in Fort Wayne. We got to keep this. Obviously, those guys are doing great, but you do have to look at the longer-term. Mm-hmm. Impacts and whether, is Ivy Tech going to now have sports at every campus? Then you can't really fundraise for all of that. Then it starts impacting budgets and you have to worry about,
Title IX concerns, things
like that.
We don't want any girls on that team because we know what that would mean.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.